Of the Coach's Corner, in and out of sports with Coach Butch McAdams. This show is sponsored in part by Horton's Funeral Services, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic Capital Region. And as always, it is powered by our great friends at the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com, and that means its founder and my producer, my main man, Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, in the locker room, in the coach's corner this evening, we have another giant. This guy is currently the editor-in-chief of the Athletic DC. He's worked for nearly 30 years covering sports for Turner, ESPN, The Washington Post. In 2016, he received the very prestigious Kirk Gowdy Media Award from the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame, and of course the Legacy Award from the National Association of Black Journalists. And I tell you what, a proud native of Washington, D.C., a graduate of DeMatha Catholic High School and American University, he is David Aldridge. Hey, D.A., always a pleasure, man. This means a lot. I know your schedule is super busy, but I'm honored to have you here in the Coach's Corner.
Oh, Butch, thank you so much for having me, man. I really, really appreciate you having me on and all the kind words you said now and over the years. It means a lot.
Well, Dave, you've always been. I always tell people I practice the three H's. First of all, being humble, being helpful, but yet remaining hungry. And you are the epitome of those three and much, much more. David, let's start off talking about, today, all over the blogs and the sports networks, talking about the restart, the NBA season 2020. How do you see it? Is it feasible? And how will it work?
Well, I think it's as feasible as anything that anyone could come up with right now. Butch, it's this is not going to be easy, no matter how, whatever, type of format you come up with in terms of where people are going to stay and they're going to be tested and all of those things. There's just so many ramifications on every decision. You want to keep the players safe. You want to keep the coaches safe. So you're going to test them as often as possible. Well, there's going to be some people who are going to be upset that rich NBA players and rich NBA coaches are getting tests when other people around the country still may be struggling to get tests, right? That's just one thing, And you would think that would be an easy thing to solve, but it's hard. It's hard from a PR standpoint, and it's also just hard from a logistical standpoint to have that number of tests available on a regular basis. If you're going to be testing a couple thousand people every other day, you've got, not just the players. If every team is 22 teams and every team is going to be able to bring in 35 people of various kinds, right? Coaches, athletic trainers, PR, you have to have some PR people there, right? You got to have all kinds of people. So that's, just kind of ballparking it. That's 800 people-ish, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Around
yeah.
800 people, that doesn't even count the people that are going to be needed just to pull a game off. That doesn't count the referees. You got to have somebody keeping stats at the scorer's table. You're going to need medical personnel who can be available in case of injuries. You need EMTs. You won't need a lot of police, but you're going to need some just to keep people from coming in, right?
Sure,
So, you're talking about, and that's just to do just to do the games. I mean, you're not even talking about the families that will be coming in at a certain point during this. It's just, it's a lot. It's a lot of tests, you know. It's a lot of people. But as I've said all along during this whole thing, Butch, if the owners want something and the players want something, it tends to get done in the NBA.
Right.
Those are the two most powerful groups by far, and both of them, the vast majority of both of those groups want to keep playing, want to resume playing, I should say. And so I think it'll get done. There will be setbacks, there will be fits and starts, but I think at the end of the day, they will have end of season, they will have a representative postseason, and they'll have a champion.
Do you foresee some players saying that, hey, I'm not comfortable with this, I'm not going to take the chance? I heard the commissioner say today that there may be some players who decide not to play, and that would not, according to him today, David, it would not be a breach of contract.
No, I mean, I agree with your assessment that there will be some players who won't play. And that, again, could be personal because of their own. Remember, now we know a lot about these players, but we don't know everything about them. There are players with pre-existing conditions who are playing in the NBA.
That's
right.
There
are players that have asthma, for example, which can be exacerbated by this virus like anything else, like any other condition. There are players that have other pre-existing conditions that may not make it safe or as safe for them to continue playing. There are players with girlfriends and wives and mothers and fathers and kids who may say, hey, dad, honey, son, uncle, nephew, I don't think it's the best idea for you to play. And they may listen to those people for different reasons, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to taking all of that into account, I would be surprised if there weren't players who didn't play. You know, I'd be more surprised if everybody showed up and played than I would be if some guys decided not to play. I just think there's too many, and not even to mention the fact, I think there may be some guys who legitimately feel like resuming playing basketball is not the right thing to do given the current climate in the country with regard to systematic racism and police brutality. They may feel, in fact, I know that some of them do feel, that this is simply not the time to start back with the kind of idolatry and fan support that fans want in terms of players coming to show up and play games for their entertainment, for the fans' entertainment. That these players have bigger issues that they think are more important right now, and they feel like going back to play could be harmful to those efforts. And I don't know if it's, you know, two players or if it's 50. I don't know.
Sure.
But I know it's not zero. Let's put it that way. I know it's not zero.
And speaking of that, Kyrie Irving has been outspoken the last couple of days or so. And he's a part of that Players Coalition?
Well, he's a vice president of the Players Association, of the Players Union. He's one of the vice presidents. There's eight of them. And he's one of them, and he has – and again, I think, you know, Kyrie is probably an imperfect messenger because, you know, he has been known to be contrary just to be a contrarian on some things. Like, I don't think there's really any debate about whether the earth is round or flat, right?
I thought we settled that ages ago.
I think Copernicus and those guys came up, you know, pretty much settled that. And there's been a whole bunch of pictures from space that kind of would show you that what the Earth shape. But again, his point, of course, I can't get inside his head. Claims he was making a point that you can't just accept conventional wisdom. You have to kind of push back on it and make people prove what they're saying. And okay, there's an esoteric thing. So what I'm saying is that Kyrie may be an imperfect messenger, but that doesn't mean that he's the only person that's bringing up these issues. He's not the only person that feels like, you know, hey, before we just sign off on this, let's think about what this is going to mean for us as players, as black men in the main. Obviously, we know there's white players in the NBA, but the vast majority of players are African American or black. You know, let's think about this for a minute before we just decide to go back to the bread and circuses.
And now leaving the NBA, my favorite sport as a spectator, Major League Baseball,
mm-hmm.
as you know or may not know, my beloved Washington Nationals, the world champions. I'm dying to see them defend that title, but it looks like that may not happen. And you talk about, David, bad PR. You've got millionaires battling billionaires in the midst of a pandemic and social unrest.
Yeah, Butch, I am not going to pretend like I'm an expert on baseball labor negotiations, because I'm not. You know, I would just say this. It would be hard for me to believe, even with the hubris that people in baseball have about baseball, that think that it's the sport that, you know, they still think it's 1941 and everybody's hanging on, you know, every word of Joe DiMaggio. You know what I'm saying? Like,
that's right.
So it's not like that anymore, and they need to come to grips with that. But I can't imagine that they will be stupid enough to not have a season this year. I mean, it just would be so dumb for them not to have any season. I mean, it's fine to discuss what kind of season you're going to want, you're going to play, how many games, and all of the other issues that we talked about before with regard to restarting a season in the middle of a pandemic. But to have no season, I just can't believe that even baseball will mess this up like that. I mean, that just
– I agree.
I just can't believe that. I just think at some level they will come up with something and have some kind of season.
David Aldridge is in the coach's corner. And, David, man, after, as I said, growing up in Washington, D.C., Northeast D.C. to be exact, before we get to your journey – to where you are now as one of the most renowned sports journalists in the land. What was it like when you received the notification that you were the recipient, I think it was 2016, of the coveted Kirk Gowdy Media Award? How'd you feel?
Well, it was a shock. It was a shock, which, I mean, I remember when I got a call, you know, from John DeLiva, and I had done stuff with the Hall over a number of years. So when he called, I thought he was just calling to ask me if I could do something else. And I'm always happy to do stuff for them. I mean, it's, you know, it's the Hall of Fame, right? I mean, so, you know, I don't mind doing stuff with them if I can do it at all. So I thought he was just had something else. And it was All-Star Weekend. We were in Toronto that year, and I thought, okay, well, maybe there's something going on. Maybe they want me to be a part of the All-Star. You know, they announced the finalists for the Hall of Fame during the Final Four. And I thought, okay, well, maybe he's going to invite me to the Final Four, and maybe he wants me to MC the luncheon or something. You know, and whatever it was, I was, you know, willing to do it. I didn't have any problem with it. But when he said, no, I'm calling because you've been selected for the Kirk Gowdy Award. I mean, it's hard for me to believe. To use your word, humbling. It was so incredibly humbling, because I know the people that are in the Hall of Fame, you know, in terms of being journalists and writers. I mean, you know David Dupree very well.
Yes.
You know, from D.C., from the Washington Post and USA Today, you know, to be in the company of someone like David Dupree or, you know, Jack McCallum and Jackie McMullen and some of the other people that are in as writers, Bob Ryan, you know, these people that literally wrote books about basketball that I read as a kid. You know what I mean? So, you know, so to be included in that group, and it was especially, I was especially, you know, moved that I got in as a writer, because I think most people probably by now think of me as a TV person, you know, someone that they've seen on TV for a long time, because I did it for 24 years, you know. So that's I'm sure a lot of people don't even know that I write or that I ever wrote, you know. So, but that's how I've always thought of myself, first and foremost. And so, you know, dating back to the days at the Post where I first started, and I've always, no matter the years I spent in TV, every year I was in TV, I still wrote every week at least about basketball for ESPN.com or for NBA.com. I mean, it's part of who I am. And so to get in as a writer, just it meant a lot. And it was just an incredibly humbling experience. And I was just so happy that I was able to get my dad and my wife and my kids to come up to Springfield to be part of it, because it, you know, that's pretty much it. And my line of work, I mean, there's not much more you're going to be able to do and get in the Hall of Fame. So.
And we're all proud for you, too, no question about it. David, let's talk about the origin of your passion and love for sport. How did it start? And who were some of the people inside the house and outside of the home that were influential?
Well, it started, Butch, from an utter inability to play it. So no matter, you name the sport, I couldn't play it. I tried them all. I tried everything. But I just could not, I did not have any natural ability or any ability of any kind, even unnatural ability, to be good at anything. I suppose I could have stuck, if I had stuck with football, I played junior varsity for about 2 weeks at DeMatha, and if I had stuck with it, I probably would have been an okay high school offensive lineman. That's probably my ceiling. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Would have been a decent, maybe reserve, occasional starter offensive lineman.
Okay.
That's what I played. But yeah, I just wasn't very good. So, but I love sports. I've always loved sports. It just has always been, you know, at a very young age, you know, when the first memories I have are watching World Series and Super Bowls and things like that. And just falling in love with the color and the excitement of an athletic contest, and you don't know who's going to win, and you root for the teams that you root for. And obviously, I was, you know, I grew up in Northeast, and my dad's still there, so you know, we grew up rooting for all the Washington teams, you know, the football team, and the, you know, and when I grew up in the 70s, the Bullets were the biggest team in town. They were the most important team in town because they were the best team in town, you know, and. You know, seeing them get to the finals all those years, and you get spoiled. You know, you just kind of think, well, it's going to be like this all the time, right? The Bullets are always going to be really good. You know, so you know, that's one of the first lessons you learn, is that these things are fleeting, and you should enjoy them while they're there, while you're in the midst of them. So, you know, I remember my dad took me, and we didn't go to many games because we couldn't get tickets most of the time.
Sure.
But every once in a while, my dad would get tickets to something. And he took me to a Bullets game against the Knicks. And this was like 1974, 75. I was 9 or 10 years old. And I had never been in the Capitol Center before. And it was the first time I had ever been in there. And I walked into that building, and I was just mesmerized by the color.
Yes.
In terms of the Knicks' blue road uniforms and the Bullets home white uniforms and the big tell screen at the old Capitol Center, and just the noise and the anticipation was, you know, the hum of the crowd and just how they reacted when, you know, the Bullets would score. And I loved Nick Weatherspoon. That was like he was my favorite player, you know. Like,
and the PA guy would say Spoon.
Exactly. That's why you fell in love with him, because Marv Brooks would go Spoon.
You know,
and he just loved that, you know. So he was my favorite player, and Elvin Hayes, those are my two favorite players, when I was a kid. So, you know, you just fell in love with that. And then, like I said, you know, the football team was good. It wasn't great, but they made the playoffs. They started making the playoffs under George Allen.
That's right.
And so you rooted for them. We didn't have a baseball team. So I wasn't all that into baseball. I listened to hockey. I didn't know anything about it, but I listened to it, you know, on the radio. You know, you try to learn the sport. So I just always kind of gravitated towards sports. It was just something I always enjoyed watching and being a fan of. And that was kind of the start of it. So when I decided, when I thought that journalism was something that I wanted to do, I mean, honestly, I still didn't think I was going to be a sports writer, but it was something that once it was offered to me, I thought, well, this could be a fun way to make a living. Why don't I try that?
Yeah. And it was a fun way to make a living while at the Post. Listen to this, folks. He had some really plum assignments, or at least on the surface, Dave, you could tell us.
Mm-hmm.
But you covered Georgetown basketball, the aforementioned Bullets, the Washington football team. You've covered Super Bowls, et cetera, et cetera, the 1992 Olympics in Spain. But talk to us about the life. Let's say take us through the life of a sports writer, a beat writer, following a team, and a normal day.
Well, it's obviously evolved over time. You know, it was very different when I covered the Bullets. I covered them for 5 years, you know, and they weren't very good, but I was 24 years old. I'll do this the rest of my life. This is fantastic. You know, I'm covering an NBA team and I'm a kid, you know? So, you know, I had just graduated from college 2 years ago and now I'm in the NBA. I'm covering NBA teams. I'm getting to see Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and Larry Bird and all those great Pistons teams up close, you know, like it just blew my mind. So,
and you're getting paid for it.
And you're getting paid for it. Sure,
yeah.
Sure. And it was a lot of work, a lot of work, and it was a lot of travel. And it's something that's best done by young single people, you know, because it's a life that's hard when you are older and married. It's just harder because your attention's divided. It was great when I was, you know, I wasn't married and I was, you know, in my 20s, so your energy level is so high, you just can do anything. You can work 18 hours and not feel it the next day, you know. And you can go to four cities in five nights, like we used to do back in the old days, you know, when you go on those West Coast trips. So you fly into Phoenix, you do a game in Phoenix, you fly to LA the next day, maybe have a night off in LA, you could go to do the Lakers game or the Clippers game the next night, then you fly to Seattle, do a game in Seattle the following night, and then you fly to Denver and do a game the following night, and that's just what we did, you know? So, you know, that was the life, and you were on the road a lot. But back in those days, what you were around the players and coaches a lot too, and that's just not, unfortunately, the way it is now. So we just had so much more access to players, and you could really develop good relationships with guys because you saw them every day, you know, whether it was at practice or at a game or even traveling. Like back in those days, we all flew commercial, you know, like the team and me got on the same plane to fly to Atlanta, you know what I mean, or wherever we were going. So you'd be on a plane with them. You know, you take the bus from the airport to the hotel with them. You know, you take the bus from the hotel to the arena with them many times on the road. And so you were just around them a lot more, and you could just be yourself and not always be on or be doing interviews. And I think that makes it's such a difference now, because now the access is so limited to players that you have to almost always be working when you're around them now. You can't just spend those quiet moments or, you know, a half hour at a guy's locker just talking like two people, like people talk, you know what I mean? Like, you know, about whatever was going on in the world back then. And that's how you got to know people, and that's how they got to know you, you know, and it was a lot easier to kind of establish relationships with people back then than it is now. It's harder now. And it makes it harder to kind of really know these guys the way that we knew those players back then.
David, talk about that thin line back in the day. And maybe it's like this currently as we speak, but as you mentioned, you're traveling with the team. You're covering the team.
Mm-hmm.
We're human. You develop relationships, but yet
right.
you have a job to do. And so talk about that thin line where a good reporter, you may develop a relationship with X player, but if
mm-hmm.
X player has an off night, you have to be objective, not an assassin, but you have to,
right.
you know, call it as you see it. So, you know, talk to us about that thin line. And I often wondered about that.
Well, it was not that difficult back then, again, because they understood it. And they respected what you had to do as a reporter. And part of that is because there were just fewer reporters back then, in all honesty, Butch. I mean, you know, the Bullets traveling media party when we go on a row would be me, the guy from the Washington Times, and the radio guy. Charlie Slows, actually, who's now
That's
the Nationals beat radio guy. So Charlie was the Bullets play-by-play guy then. So that was the traveling party. It was the three of us. That was it. So they just weren't bombarded with 50, 60 people all pointing their cell phones at them from the minute they walk into the arena, you know, and you know, doing interviews with them pregame and all the things that we kind of take for granted now. So they understood my job. I used to always tell them, we can be friendly, but I don't think we can be friends.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Just because it would be very difficult for me to write a story about my friend, right? I mean, because, you know, your friend is a human being. He or she makes mistakes. He or she does things that they shouldn't do. And it would be difficult for me to write a story about that, you know? So what I always used to tell the guys was, the bar's off the record, for one. You can tell me anything you want in the bar and I won't put it in the paper. And number two, I don't care what you do at the club. I don't care. Okay. So if we go to the club and I see you at the club and you're married and you're, you know, doing something with somebody that's not your wife, I'm not going to write about them the next day.
No.
Because it's not my business, and it's not the business of the people that read this, that follow this team and read my story. What I told them, Butch, was, if you get arrested, I have to write about them.
Yeah.
So don't get arrested. Okay. I would tell them that all the time. Just don't show up in a police report and we're good. You know? And they understood that. You know, so
wow.
So we, with those rules, we had a very fair working relationship, I think, over the course of time. But they understood my job. And to your other point, they knew when they – look, you know this, Bush. Players know when they stink. They know it. You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
You know, so it's not – if I say that Jeff Malone went 3 of 14, he really struggled from the floor, he knows that. You know, so it's when you say Jeff Malone, who was out till 5 in the morning last night, went 3 of 14 from the floor. That they may have a problem with what you write. When you try to correlate one thing to another, because he may have gone 3 of 14 for a number of reasons, some of which may have had nothing to do with the fact he was out. You know, and I'm not – Jeff usually
sure.
doesn't go out that much, so I'm not saying –
Right.
So I'm just using it as an example. You just say he struggled, he didn't play well, they didn't play well as a team, they got blown out, and leave it at that. But it's when you start to, you know – make judgments about their character or say they don't care or they don't work hard or they're not doing this, that, and the third, that's when guys would have a problem with you, you know, because you're saying things, you're assigning their results to things that may not be accurate in terms of why things happened.
You know, David, I would imagine, looking at your past assignments, I would imagine that you were told, well, David, I got some good news and bad news. And you would say, well, all right, give me the bad news. You're covering the Georgetown Hoyas. All right, what's the good news? You're covering the Georgetown Hoyas. What was it like covering the Hoyas with a guy that both of us, we just love, Big John? He's my main man. I know you love him and respect him. But that must have been a difficult task, Hoya paranoia.
Well, it wasn't. It was in the sense that you knew you weren't going to get anything, right? You weren't going to get any information. But the thing that made you relax, or at least it made me relax, is that nobody else was getting it either. You know what I mean?
Okay,
like,
okay.
It wasn't like, you know, he talked to one paper and he didn't talk to me, or he talked to a TV station and he didn't talk to me. As long as John didn't play favorites and kept all the media at arm's length, I could live with that. I could live with that. You know, it wasn't ideal, but as long as I wasn't getting beat on stories, I could live with it, you know? You know, and it was obvious that that's how he operated, and it was okay. I was fine with that. It wasn't the one thing that bothered me was the paranoia got to the point where you could not even talk to the guys. And again, that was my first beat. That was before I covered the Bullets.
Mm-hmm.
So my first beat is covering Georgetown. I'm 23 at the time. I had just graduated from college the year before. So if I see Dikembe Mutombo in the locker room and he's telling me about these classes he's taken, I'm just curious as a person who just was a student about what the
right.
class is like. I don't want to write a story about it. I'm just like, oh, that's interesting that you're taking this diplomatic history class. Tell me about it. You know, and then to have one of the assistant coaches say, you know, you don't ask him about his schoolwork. And I'm like, I'm just talking to him. I don't have a notepad. We're just talking like people talk, you know. So that was frustrating because, you know, they're just the ulterior motives that they assume every reporter has are just like, come on, guys. Come on. But other than that, it was fine because you knew John would talk after games and you knew that John would return your phone call. Now, it would be at 2 in the morning, but that was okay. I never minded that, Bush. That was okay.
Do you have a favorite Coach Thompson story that you could share with our listeners this evening?
Oh, wow. Well, it depends on... It depends on how much
G-rated, of course.
Say. I don't know.
G-rated.
No, I would just say, you know, there was nothing in particular that year. I mean, there were things subsequent years I would just remember the year I covered them, they got into a lot of fights. They got into a lot of fights that year. And that was the Big East back then. So it was okay. I mean, it wasn't like, but they got into, you know, they got into a fight with Pittsburgh and they got into fights with Syracuse, and it was just everybody. Every other game, they were having a fight. So I just remember. I think we were at Providence. They were playing Providence, and that was when Pitino was at Providence. And they wound up winning the game. And I had asked John something. They had the lead. They blew the lead. They came back. You know, they held on at the end. They won the game. And I asked John some X and O question. I can't even remember what it was. And, you know, John rises up and leans into the microphone and looks right at you as he was wont to do and says something like, oh, so you know something about basketball now that you're going to ask me a question about why I did this. You know, of course, I just felt like an inch tall. And, you know, he threw a few other adjectives in there that I'm not going to include.
Oh, yeah.
For purposes of our discussion. So, you know, it was just fun. It was fun talking to John. I liked John. I really did. I enjoyed talking to John about work and about his team, but also about, you know, again, stuff that was going on in the world, because that was right around the time of Prop 42, was that it? I'm trying to, or Prop 48,
yeah.
I think it was, you know. So obviously he had some very strong feelings about that. I wrote pieces about it, but, you know, I just enjoyed being around him. It was a fun time. It was not one of their better teams. They lost in the second round of the tournament that year. They did not, I had them the one year they didn't have an All-American center in the 10 years that they had All-American centers. So I was after, I got them after Patrick left and before Alonzo and Dikembe, you know, were there. But that's fine. It was, But it was fun. It was a great, you know, the Big East was great back then. Great. And
yeah.
to go up to the Carrier Dome and see them play Syracuse and see Sherman Douglas, you know, at his absolute best, and Derek Coleman really, you know, as a young, dominant power forward. And then, you know, they goes and then play Boston College, and I think Michael Adams was at Boston College at the time and playing great for them. And then, you know, Villanova had – this was after the national championship, but Villanova was still good. You know, some of those players were still on that team. You know, and Pitt had Jerome Lane, and they had Charles Smith, who both wound up in the NBA for many years. You know, it was just – the league was just great. And I grew up, again, as a kid, younger kid, watching the Big East kind of evolve and grow. And so if you're sitting in Madison Square Garden – and Syracuse or St. John's is playing Georgetown. That's pretty cool. You know, that's pretty cool. And I get to write
cool.
a story about it. You know what I mean? That's pretty
yeah.
cool. So it was a great, I only did it for a year, but it was so much fun. And I got to cover the Final Four that year. And that was the year that, Kansas won, Danny Manning and the Miracles, that year. And it was great. And it was, you know, that game, the final, they played with Oklahoma with, one of the greatest mm-hmm. games I've ever covered. It was 50-50 at the half. You know what I mean? Like that, they were just going up and down, back up and down the floor. And Oklahoma had Mookie Blaylock, and they had Harvey Grant, and you know they had a bunch of guys that wound up playing in the pros, and so did Kansas. You know, so it was a great year. It was just a great fun year to cover college basketball.
David Aldridge is in the coach's corner, and David. When you covered the burgundy and gold, was it during the glory years of Coach Joe Gibbs?
No, see, Butch, I was the kiss of death as a beat writer. I just put that out there. You did not want me covering your team.
Oh, when they saw
you
walking through the door, they said, oh, we're in bad shape.
It's just, we're going to be bad for a while. No, my high water mark for that team was 6-10. That was the best.
Oh, my goodness. Get
the 3 years I covered it. First year was the year after Gibbs left. So I had Richie Pettibones 1 year as head coach when they went 3-13. And then they hired North Turner, and they went 4-12. And then they bumped it up to a robust 6-10 my last year. So, they were not good. But, you know, again, you learn so much about people when they're losing as opposed to when they're winning. And so, you know, I will always remember guys like Brian Mitchell and Daryl Green and Tim Johnson and Jim Lachey, who were stand-up people when those teams were really bad. And they never, like, said no comment. They always answered the questions, even though it was tough and they were not doing well. You know, they understood, again, what you had to do for a living. And as long as you were fair to them, they would be fair to you. So even covering bad football teams, you still learned so much about people and how people responded when times were rough, when things were bad. Because everybody wants to talk when you win. You know, everybody's happy when you win. And people stay around, you know, locker rooms open forever after a win. But when you lose, it's and you lost by, you know, 38-3 like they did in Dallas that 1 year. That's when you learn about who's a stand-up person and who's there, who's a front runner and who's a workhorse, you know. And I always respected more the people that showed up when times were tough and would talk to you.
You know, David, I've listened to you on podcasts and radio shows, and you're pretty passionate when it comes to the burgundy and gold. And a lot of times you put your press credential and your pen and pad and
mm-hmm.
your computer down, and you become Dave the Fan. And
mm-hmm.
and I'm saying, boy, you're speaking for me as native Washingtonians. What will it take for that organization to get back to close to being competitive?
Well,
you know, we can debate whose fault it is, but I'm going to say
mm-hmm.
that the buck stops at the owner.
Well, always, sure. It always starts and stops with the owner. So I will give him this. You know, he did at least understand that no matter how he justified keeping Bruce Allen around as long as he did, that they had to get rid of Bruce Allen, that he simply was not credible anymore as the you know, spokesperson for the franchise for a number of different reasons, and that they had to make really substantive changes. Now, you can argue, and many do, and I would have no argument with that, that this is a decade late, but at least they recognized, at least he finally recognized it and made the changes, the big changes that needed to be made. And he's given his coach, Ron Rivera, you know, kind of the rubber stamp to do what he needs to do to try and rebuild that team. And he's, you know, they kept A.J. Smith around, not A.J. Smith, his son, around to kind of Kyle Smith to kind of be the, if not the GM in title, certainly the GM in terms of player development personnel. You know, and so I think fairness dictates that you give this new group a couple of years to kind of put their stamp on it and see if they can improve it on the on-field product, because the on-field product has been laughable for the last several years. It's been laughably bad. And, you know, the front office has been laughably bad. And so if these people are empowered to kind of do things the way that they think they should be done and the way that other good organizations do them, then I will have, you know, I think we all have to give them a couple of years to see if they can do it, you know, and see what they can get, where they can get Dwayne Haskins to be, you know, see if Chase Young indeed elevates the rest of that defense with a whole lot of first round picks on it, you know, and high draft picks on it. I still don't know that they're going to be a playoff team next year, but I think people will be patient if they just see an increase in not just the competitiveness, because they were competitive a lot of games, not all of them, but a lot of games. But it didn't matter because you knew that the organizational rot was so pervasive that they would never be able to sustain it. Even if they won a game or two, they'd never be able to sustain it because they just did not have people in place that you could build upon. You could build a championship organization around.
That's right.
And I mean both on and off the field. And then they would bring people in, and then they'd fire them after a year, you know? So so I will give them – I'm wait and see. I'm not going to make judgments off of 1 year, because you got to give a coach a year to get rid of the people he wants to get rid of first, and then he'll start bringing in the people he wants to bring in. So we have to allow that. We have to allow for that. But I do like some of the things that I've heard about bringing in higher character people, again, on and off the field, and really putting a premium on people that do things the right way, and don't skip steps, because I think there's no shortcut to winning. You got to do the work, the hard work of getting better.
As I always say, one of your mentors in mine, Coach Morgan Wooten, would always say the elevator to success is always out of order. You have to take the steps.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And he was right.
Talk to us about the various roles, and do you have a preference? As you stated, you've been a beat writer, you're a
mm-hmm.
columnist, a sideline guy, studio guy, et cetera. Do you have a preference?
I guess I would say if I had a preference, it's always – well, I shouldn't say always. My preference tends to gravitate towards writing. And I think, again, I think beat writing is something that young people are probably better at than I am. And I'm old enough now to think that I have an opinion on everything and I want to express it. So I think what I'm doing now, kind of writing columns about, you know, the NBA and about the local sports teams is kind of what I want to do. And it's one of the reasons I went to the Athletic. I wasn't unhappy at Turner at all. I loved working for Turner. It was the best place I ever worked. They did everything first class. People were first class. And I loved everybody there. It was just a fantastic group. But the travel was just getting hard, but it was getting hard for me. And when you have kids and you want to be around them before they leave and go to college and go on with their lives, you only get a certain amount of time before they're gone, you know? So, I wanted a job where I could be home more. I wanted a job where I could write more. While I really respect TV and the kind of visceral reaction people have to what they see on TV, and it's much different than the reaction they have when they read something that you've written. I just feel more, I guess, more like myself when I'm writing. You know, it's kind of who I am comes out more in my writing, I think, than it did when I was on TV, because TV is just, it's a very tough medium for your true personality to come out. There's just not enough time. You know, everything that you do is in terms of seconds. You know, you have 45 seconds here. You have a minute and a half here. You know, you have 2 minutes here. And it's very difficult for someone's personality to really come out in that short a period of time. And so, you know, so to me, I guess writing kind of allows me to kind of express myself a little closer to the person I think I actually am than television did. And you just, you know, it doesn't mean television is bad. It's not. It is the most powerful medium we have, and the most influential. But it's not conducive to really letting your real personality come out.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of Turner, that studio group, Charles Barkley, mm-hmm. Kenny Smith, Shaq, etc., they're the best in the business. That chemistry is unbelievable. Charles Barkley, I love him, and Kenny is the perfect partner for him. And then you add Shaq in the mix. That's worth the price of admission, even without the game.
Well, no question. They're the best studio show in the history of the medium. It's not especially close to me. I mean, I can't even imagine that someone would come up with a studio show that they think is in any way comparable to it in any sport. I'm not just talking about the NBA. It's just nothing compares to it. And it's because of that group. It's because Ernie Johnson's the best studio host in the history of television, in my opinion. I think he's better at this than anybody else who's ever done it. He has a remarkable ability to know how to keep a conversation flowing and also to know when to stop it, which is very difficult because you're talking about guys who are all great players who have big egos and feel like their every word is, you know, a sermon on the mount and must be heard. And, you know, Ernie didn't play in the NBA, and for him to say, okay, Shaq, that's enough, we got to move on. And for Shaq to go, okay, Ernie, I mean, that tells you the respect that they have for him, you know. Mm-hmm. And it works because Charles Barkley, who, as you know, was not a good player. He was a great player. He was a great basketball player and a superstar, and one of the biggest superstars that the league had for a long time, allows them to make fun of him all the time. And it's very rare that you find someone who was as good as Charles. Mm-hmm. It's different when it's a guy who's a role player and doesn't really have that, okay, you can make fun of them and they have to take it, right? Mm-hmm. Charles doesn't have to take it. Charles could say, I'm Charles Barkley. I'm one of the 50 greatest players of all time. I played on the Dream Team. I was the MVP, and you can't make fun of me. And if you keep making fun of me, I'll have you fired. And guess what? They would have to do it. They'd have to do it because he's that big a star. But he lets them, they clown him every week without even laughs at it. He doesn't even, like, take it seriously, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's why that show works, because everybody understands that the show is what matters, not the person. And so if the show requires them to make fun of Chuck or to make fun of Shaq or to make fun of Kenny or to make fun of Ernie, they all accept that, you know, and that takes a lot of kind of personal understanding of oneself and being secure in oneself, but it also takes a lot of sacrifice. It really does. It's hard to do that on television when people see it and they tend to believe what they see is the truth. You know, and that's why I've always said, Butch, that when I first started in TV, and it was local, it was here in D.C., when I was covering the football team, and George Michael had a show every week, and I learned so much in those 2 years of doing that show with him and Sonny Jurgensen and John Riggins.
Yeah.
But the main thing I learned watching George every week is that George would sacrifice his own ego to make me look better because it made the show better. So George would say things. He would ask me questions that he already knew the answer to. He would say things that he knew were wrong because he knew that I could say, no, George, that's not it. It's this instead because it made the show better. You know, or he would do the same thing and let Riggins say something, come back at him. And you have to be really secure as a person to do that. And he did it every week, you know. And you notice that after a while. You notice, okay, this guy isn't stupid. He's really smart, actually. But he understands there's a bigger picture here. For him to do that taught me so many lessons about understanding who you are and not taking yourself too seriously. And that's why I would always say, Butch, I take what I do seriously. I don't take myself seriously at all.
That's right. Yeah, you would always tell me that.
Big difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the plum assignments, I would imagine, and looking at your resume, and I would say, okay, that's impressive. But this, if I could have been David Aldridge, I would have chosen this assignment. 1992, summer, Barcelona, Spain. Dream team. Talk about that. And can you share with our listeners, because you were there, what you know, the whole Isaiah controversy. We know that he was talent-wise, certainly an all-star, a dream team member, but there's so many rumors about this person didn't want him, that person didn't want him, and the irony, David, was his coach was the coach of the team, Chuck Daly.
That's correct. It is the pinnacle to me of what I've been able to do over 30 years was getting to cover that team. And it's the one assignment I went into my boss's office and said, I want to cover this. I want this. Because most of the time you are just kind of told, okay, you're going to cover this team from now on. And you go, okay, and you start covering that team, right? That's how it usually works. And I went into George Solomon's office and I said, George, I cover the NBA. I cover the Bullets. I want to cover the Dream Team. And he, to his credit, after thinking about it for a while, he said, okay, you got it. And he let me do it. And I think I did okay. And it was by far, I think, the and most rewarding assignment I ever had. It was the first Olympics I ever covered. I've done three of them now, and they've all been wonderful in different ways, but that was the first one in Spain. It's just a breathtakingly beautiful country. It's just insanely beautiful country. And the people were just incredibly, just wonderful people to be around the whole time we were there. That was it. You're right. That was the highlight of my career, to be there, to be around them that whole year, not just in Barcelona, but, you know, when they first started in San Diego and in Portland. I didn't get to go to Monte Carlo because Wilbon bigfooted me on that one. It's all right. He was a columnist. That's what they do. So, but I did cover everything else. So other than that 1 week in Monte Carlo, I covered every other thing that the Dream Team did together. And it was great. As far as Isaiah goes, I mean, look, no secret, Jordan didn't want him on the team. You know, I mean, I think Jordan, you know, it's hardly a newsflash. I mean, I think everybody understands that. I will say this. I don't think Jordan was the only person that didn't want him on the team.
But he certainly
was the most – he was the most important one who didn't want him on the team. Like, if it had just been Scottie Pippen, for example, I think they would have still put Isaiah on the team. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
They would have said, okay, Scottie, you got to suck it up. He's going to be on the team. He deserves to be on the team. We all know Isaiah deserved to be on the team. You know, it's preposterous to suggest that he didn't deserve to be on the team. But that doesn't mean you get to be on the team. You know, I mean, it's just you get picked. At that time, they had a selection committee. And to your point, not only was Chuck Daly the coach, Jack McCloskey was on the selection committee.
Yeah.
Jack McCloskey was the GM of the Pistons. So, you know, I'll just say that while I don't think that Michael should be absolved of blame, if you want to say blame, for his role in it, because he certainly made it clear he didn't want to play with Isaiah. And he wasn't the only person, you know, and there were different reasons for that. Some were probably unfair. And it's not like heaven and earth were moved on the selection committee to make sure that Isaiah was on that team.
Sure, sure. Now, speaking of Michael Jordan, The Last Dance, great documentary, 10-part series. The timing was good, and I was especially proud at seeing you and multiple times appear in the documentary. But talk to us about what was Michael Jordan like to cover? Because, you know, looking at the guy, from a coaching standpoint and from a competitive standpoint, I said, I would love to play with this guy because he's going to make me as good as I can possibly be. And he appeared to be open to the press. But share with us, what was it like covering Michael Jordan?
Well, which I've always said early, the first, I don't know, I started covering the league in 88, so I wasn't there his first 4 years. But I was there for the rest of his career. You know, the first 4 or 5 years I covered the league, he was very accessible. I mean, very accessible for someone who was as big a star as he was. You know, he, at the old Chicago Stadium, when you went into the Bulls locker room, his locker was the very first locker that you would see, that you would run into as you come into the door. His locker was immediately to the right of the door. So as soon as you walk in the room, if you look to your right, there he is, right? So you would do that. I mean, I did it. I'm not the only person who did it. So I, you know, at the time, the Bullets would go to Chicago twice a year. And so I would go in, and he would love to gossip. He loved to learn. What's going on around the league? What are you hearing? You know, what are they doing? Are there any trades going on? And he would tell him what you had heard, and he'd tell you what he'd heard, and you know, you could talk to him like a person. I mean, he was just sitting there. It wasn't anybody else. It wasn't I wasn't interviewing him. You just talked to him. You could talk to him. You know, now he would usually have like 500 tickets that he was trying to distribute. And then invariably someone from PR would come because he almost always, and this was the thing, one of the things that nobody really knows, almost every home game for, how long was he in Chicago? 10 years?
Yeah.
Almost every home game, he would do a make-a-wish with the kid before every game. I shouldn't say every game. Before a lot of games. I'll put it that way. He had a lot of make-a-wish kind of meetings that had been set up because that's what kids wanted. It's what kids in those situations want. They wanted to meet Michael Jordan. And he would do that. And so they would say, hey, you got a Make-A-Wish meeting in 5 minutes. And he would say, I got to go. And okay. But you could talk to him. He was accessible. He was pretty accessible. Now, what happened, Butch, was as he got bigger and the league got bigger, the media got bigger. And so you would start to, sometimes maybe there would be 3 people around him or 5 people around him. And it was 15, and then it became 30, and then it grew exponentially. And all of a sudden, it's 100. And so now he can't do the interview at his locker because nobody else can move around in the locker room. So now you have to take him to the podium, which, again, kind of reduces that individual meeting time that you used to be able to have with him. And it just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where it became really difficult to have any type of interaction with him because there was 500 media from around the world now that are following every move that he makes and everything that he says. So, you know, but I always enjoyed Michael's company. You know, when he came here with the Wizards, I enjoyed talking to him. He would still talk, you know, not all the time, but there were times where he would talk to you, you know, on, you know, in the hallway or something. So I always had a good relationship with him. I never had a bad relationship with him the whole time he was in Chicago and the whole time he was here in D.C.
We've got about 6 minutes left, David. I'm really enjoying this. I know our listeners are as well. Did you have, on a professional level, a adverse relationship with any of the star players for one reason or another, that they maybe misunderstood something you had written and they didn't want to talk with you anymore? Did you have experience
with
that?
Not really. I mean, Lambert was kind of a jerk, but he was kind of a jerk to everybody. so it wasn't unique to me. You know, Kobe and I got sideways when he was with the Lakers, when he was playing, you know, kind of midway through his career, for something very innocuous that I was completely right about, and that they tried to, you know, you can't possibly write the truth about something that happened without people getting angry about it. But you know, it didn't last forever, and I'm very lucky and fortunate. His last 2 years, we had a better relationship at the end. We really did. He was a little more humble, I think, and I was a little older probably, you know, so it was a good combination. It was a good time for us to kind of talk to each other in a different kind of way, and we did. We had some really good conversations his last couple of years as a player. But other than that, no, not really. And again, I wasn't the guy that was going to, like, I didn't have a poison pen. That wasn't what I did. You know, some people do that, and that's their shtick. Okay, that's their shtick. I never felt comfortable doing it. I thought to try and do that would be me being phony, and I didn't want to be a phony. I just wanted to be myself. I think just writing what you see and not kind of extrapolating deeper meaning to what you see, I think takes you a long way in this game. And I think players – you know, the biggest compliment I would get, and that people still give me on occasion, is that, you know, the players respect you because
That's
they
right.
know you don't take shots. You don't take shots at them. You know, you just keep it straight. You play it straight. And that's what I think we should do, you know. And if you can do it, if you make a living doing it the other way, look, God, go with God. I'm not here to judge.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just not – I just didn't feel comfortable doing it that way, Butch.
No, you have to be true to to yourself and your personality. Talk about your relationship with two guys that I know your friends and possibly mentors. One would be the aforementioned Michael Wilbon, and the other
mm-hmm.
is Tony Kornheiser.
Well, they're both are friends and mentors. You know, I've always said, Butch, I saw PTI 10 years before it was ever on the air because it's the exact same thing they did in the office when I was
that's
at the
right.
You know, that's their relationship. This is a one where they're screaming and yelling across the hallway at each other.
I love it.
The newsroom at each other. It's what they did. So it was very genuine. I think that's one of the reasons PTI has been on so long, is because it's obvious that these two people really care about each other, you know? So they're both very, very good friends and mentors and people who have helped me, you know, do things that have really been beneficial to my career, you know, just kind of learning about how to deal with people, how to interview people, how to write, you know, what the process is like, you know, being part of Tony's various radio shows and podcasts. And this is what I've always said about Tony is that, and I look, Tony's far from a perfect person. We all understand that, you know, but who among us is, you know,
that's
close
right.
to being perfect, right?
That's right.
But what I've said is that Tony would have women reporters, female reporters on, and he would have black reporters on when a lot of white guys who had that job didn't, okay? A lot of white guys who had that position and that power didn't, okay? And he did, and he didn't do it because somebody told him to do it. He just did it because he thought it was the right thing to do. And so that's why I will always have a very soft place in my heart for Tony, because it wasn't just me. You know, it wasn't just people who worked at the Post. You know, he put Mike Freeman on the air.
That's
you
right.
know, he put a lot of people, Stephen A. Smith on the air. He put a lot of people on the air before they were big, quote unquote, you know, and gave people that opportunity to talk about sports. And so I will always respect him for that. And Mike and I think, have a closer personal relationship just because, you know, Mike is like a big brother to me. You know, I mean, he, you know, taught me so much just about how you deal with people, and just watching him around people, you know, even now when he's, you know, at this incredibly big level of stardom, to see him walk through an arena or a stadium, and just the kindness he shows to people, you know, in terms of taking a minute to listen to them or take a picture or give them an autograph, all those things. You watch that and you learn from that. And I like to think I try to do the same thing with people in my much smaller level of celebrity than it is. But, you know, so, but he also just taught me a lot about being a reporter and being, you know, one of the first African-American sports columnists in this country. You know, he wrote some really tough columns that had to be written, and he wasn't afraid, you know, and he had to say things that sometimes were unpleasant. And he said them because they needed to be said. And that taught me a lot about, if you ever get a column or an opportunity to write about things like race and about gender and other things that are going on, you have to write about them. You can't be unflinching, and you have to write what you see and be honest about it. So, they're both, as I said, very longtime friends that have taught me a lot about the business and about people.
Mm-hmm. I would be remiss not to mention your time in what I would call the ultimate sports town, and a tough town, Philadelphia, and writing for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Talk to us about Philadelphia as a sports town.
I came to love Philly as a sports town, and I was, you know, I had the same kind of stereotypical thoughts about Philly fans when I got there that most people do. But I came to realize they were really smart. They really knew their sports. They were really passionate. And, you know, the yahoos that call into the sports radio show stations up there are not representative of the sports fans there. The sports fans who've been there, who are natives of that city, really know their history, and they know what they're talking about. And you should listen to them because they're pretty, you know, and they can teach you a few things. And so I came to like Philly very much as a sports town, because no matter what I wrote, no matter what sport I wrote about, whether it was the Phillies or the Eagles or the Sixers or Villanova or Temple, or, you know, I wrote like one hockey story, as I don't pretend to be a hockey expert, you know. But whatever I wrote about, I would always get this really smart, passionate response from fans. It doesn't mean they agree with me. Well, a lot of times they disagree with me, but they knew what they were talking about. And you can tell. You can tell the difference. And so I really came to respect that town as a true sports town. They love sports, and they are incredibly passionate and knowledgeable about them.
Well, that paper is always near and dear to my heart because of you. And, of course, another great friend of mine, Washingtonian, Kevin Tatum,
was
there
the
for years. And then I just interviewed.
I had no idea how good Kevin was as a player. I didn't know. He never talked about it. Never mentioned it.
Well, my favorite Kevin Tatum story, we were at the annual Father's Day cookout that his friends and family would give, legendary cookout.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
He got into a typical D.C. summertime basketball debate with another guy who was a guard who made All Met and who was better. So the guy said, well, I made first team All Met. And Kevin looked at him and said, yeah, but I made four other people first team All Met. That's how good Kevin Tatum was. He was the engine of that great 69 Tech team. And then, of course, the coach of that team, McKinley Armstrong, his daughter has been a columnist for the Metro for years. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Janice
and
Armstrong.
I know Janice. I mean, I knew Janice very well when I was in Philly. And I just, and he would, you know, when guys know the sport, and you would talk to him about it, and, you know, he would always be like, well, you know, I played a little bit back in the day, you know, and I felt like an idiot. When people said, wait a minute, you know that's Kevin Tatum, right?
Right.
Oh, my God.
Well, let me put it this way for our younger listeners out there. In my opinion, Kevin Tatum was Muggsy Bogues before Muggsy.
How about that?
Yeah. That's how good he was. And speaking of good, David, you're just the best, man. We've got 3 minutes left. I always ask our guests to leave our listeners with some parting shots. We call it wow, words of wisdom.
Well, I mean, I don't have a whole ton of things. I would just say, you know, from my perspective, you know, I think it's very important for reporters to understand that they don't know everything and they shouldn't pretend like they do, you know. And the worst thing you can do is pretend you know more than you actually do. And it's okay to say, I don't know, or I don't understand, or can you explain that to me? Because I don't understand what you're saying, you know. And I think you go a lot further with people when you acknowledge that you're not an expert. I think especially with young people, they tend to believe that they have to pretend to be experts at a young age. I'm not an expert. I wasn't an expert at 24. I didn't know anything. You know what I mean? I didn't know anything. So I listened to people who did. I would just say, no matter what it is you're doing, it's really important to listen to other people. And I think especially now in our country, it would be nice if people would actually listen to other people who are telling them what's going on in the world and what our reality is, and that our reality is probably a little different from your reality, but it doesn't mean that our reality isn't true, you know? And so if people would be willing to listen and understand that change is possible and it's hard work, it's very hard work, but it is possible if we listen to people who are telling us what's going on and do things to help them have better lives.
Sure.
I think we all would have better lives, but it gets back to listening. And so I think listening would go a long way. Actually listening, not hearing, listening.
There's
and
a
acting
difference.
Upon that. Yeah.
David Aldridge, as always, man, you hit a walk-off grand slam in the bottom of the 10th inning. In the 7th game of the World Series against, we're both national fans, so let's say against the New York Yankees. How's that?
There you
Thank
go.
You so much, David.
My pleasure, Butch. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, folks. And that was the Hall of Fame writer, journalist. He is our own David Aldridge. And up next, in the Coach's Corner, in and out of sports, we're going to have two guests coming Thursday. We're going to have Shelley Flood, the daughter of Curt Flood, who revolutionized not just baseball, but major league sports in this country. And also, we would have Andrea Chamblee, who is the author of the hottest basketball book around, The Capital of Basketball. And it gives the historic decades of D.C. area basketball. So all that and more coming up this Thursday. But for now, I want to thank our sponsors, Horton's Funeral Service. Hey, give them a call, 202-829-9000, 202-829-9000. And, of course, Dr. Edward T. Buford, Give him a call at 202-667-8818, 202-667-8818. And as always, I want to thank my man, Rick Hampton Sr., for making this show possible. And always, folks, go to theAfricanAmericanAthlete.com. Again, it's theAfricanAmericanAthlete.com for all of the stories that are important to us and to listen to previous shows. But for now, make good decisions, because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid. We'll see you on Thursday.
Listen to a 30-second demo.